Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I am pleased once again to be talking with Alderville Chief Tainar Simpson. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You just returned from the Assembly of First Nations General Assembly in Ottawa. Before we dive into the details, what was your sense of the mood at the Assembly?
I think generally the mood for this Assembly was positive, with the exception of knowing we have a lot of work ahead of us. We have some major issues that we were discussing in terms of the child welfare, major projects, and some other really big issues like the First Minister's meeting that's coming up in October. So I think there's a lot of optimism, but there's a lot of hesitation as well, too, because we don't want to get our hopes up too much about how things might go. But it was definitely a way that people were thinking that there's some bright lights ahead potentially for First Nations in Canada.
There were a lot of resolutions that you guys had to get through on a very short timeline. What was your sense of the amount that you were tackling?
Well, I think this is always the time to pass these important resolutions that we've been working on. There never seems to be enough time for a fulsome discussion on each one. There's a lot of plenary discussions that are happening intermittently throughout the 3 days that we're there. So I think it'd be great if we had more time for the discussion, but generally near the end for all the resolutions that hadn't been passed, they put them together in a basket or omnibus resolution where we discuss all of them at once in slightly related categories. So we did get most of them passed. Some were pulled back and others there was really good discussion about how we were going to proceed. So it's also a chance for other First Nation chiefs and proxies to suggest friendly amendments or not so friendly amendments. So, but this is the way to get the discussion going and get the direction given to the AFN.
It's usually a hallmark of the Assembly that a number of politicians from various levels of government come and speak. What was your sense of the presentations from those people?
Well, it's always nice to see them show up. It means that, there's a good relationship with First Nations. Generally, doesn't really matter what party they're from. They're going to speak from the party line. And it's usually nothing we haven't heard before. There'll never be a big announcement to the chiefs at the AFN. Generally, the opposition parties will say that they are in support of First Nations. They want to help us. And that the power, currently the Liberals, will say that, we have challenges ahead and we're going to do our best, but, we have limitations. So it's always the same, no matter who's in power, but it's always filled with positive and forward-looking speeches, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate into action.
Let's delve into some specifics. Let's first of all talk about the major projects. One of the big issues coming from the Assembly was concerns from the government is moving too quickly on major projects without consulting First Nations, along with additional concerns about environment. Can you characterize the debate that took place on this topic?
I think the consensus is that there is no need to try to shorten the consultation process because we're already doing it as quickly as we can. And these often take years for specific projects. What the federal government's trying to do is get all that down into a 1 year time frame, which is pretty impossible, even if everything is working right. The problem has been that they come to the table too late. They start consultations and then that timer starts ticking, but they don't actually engage in consultation till near the very end of that period. And they're trying to get everything done at once and seek our consent. So I believe that you can't ram something through quickly without actually taking the steps that you would need to take to get everything done in that 1 year period. They also have introduced a 30-day pre-consultation process for the major projects if they're contemplating putting them into the major projects office. Streamline, they're supposed to consult with us for 30 days. Now, we've seen this with a recent project where they said they were thinking about doing it. That was 30 days starting. They didn't reach out to us until just a couple days before that deadline and expected to get this already shortened 30-day consultation process in a couple of days. So they really need to shore up consultation if they want to try to streamline it, because it's not off to a good start right now.
Some listeners may be saying, hold on a moment, a year seems like a long time, and you're saying it can take even longer than that. Why does it take so long on your side?
Well, it's due diligence, because these projects are happening often in pristine areas. We need to do archaeological assessments. We need to make sure that sites of significant archaeological significance aren't being destroyed. So that takes time to do the proper archaeology. You have to do your stage one and stage two. Oftentimes, like with the over the Arctic radar systems, they're chock full of artifacts. So we need to be able to, at the very least, remove everything that's there so that the project can go on. There's environmental assessments that need to happen to determine what sort of impact that's going to have. You have your impact assessment process that needs to happen to ensure that nothing's going to be overly negatively impacted. So you have all these studies that need to be done for by what is their definition, a major project. So you want to make sure you have a solid foundation before you go into these major things. So this is why I want as much chance to get our studies done as possible.
Is there no way that a compromise can be made?
Well, I think that there is a middle ground. I'm going to say that there has to be a lot of acceptance on the federal government side of how to properly run these projects. I think that there shouldn't be all this waffling, will they or won't they put something into the major projects office. If they know they're going to do it, be honest, say, this is something we're planning on doing. And then we can start our studies right then. As soon as they say, okay, we're going to build this project, great. We can start our archaeology. We can start our environmental assessment. And the government would also need to truthfully and honestly engage in consultation right then and there, and not just put everything on the back burner for discussion. And then at the very end of the consultation process, say, okay, now we want to consult. This is something that needs to happen. I believe if they were to engage properly right off the beginning, if they were able to give us the proper heads up that a project's going to happen so we can do our studies, we would be able to do things a lot quicker than we are doing it now. We are usually ready to go to conduct our studies, our impact assessments, our archaeological and our environmental studies. These are stuff that we know how to do, and we know how to do it very well. It's just a matter of getting the buy-in from the federal government to start going when we're ready to go. And I think if all of those things came together, we would be able to do things a lot quicker than we currently are doing them, and maybe even within the timeframes that the federal government seems to want.
You mentioned a couple of times environmental considerations. Can you elaborate a little bit on what that means?
Well, they would change depending on the project. If you're looking at, say, a nuclear generation site that's doing a deep water intake for the cooling of the reactors, you need to find out what kind of fish are going to be there, what the disturbance of the lake bed would look like, how are you going to mitigate that, what are you going to do with all of the material pulled from the lake bed. And say something like the radar sites, you need to ensure that you're not affecting species at risk, that maybe you're destroying a habitat where something needs that habitat, and it's one of the only places. So without knowing what you've got, you can't just go in and destroy something for a project without fully understanding that impact you're having. And again, species at risk is a major one for First Nations, as well as all harvesting. If there's some kind of migratory path for birds or animals through there, you want to make sure you're mitigating, or perhaps being able to identify a near adjacent site that would have less of an impact.
There was a discussion about putting forward a constitutional change that would embed the recognition of inherent treaty and human rights. Can you explain what was going on there?
I think I remember that discussion. We know that the inherent rights are already ingrained in Section 35 of the Constitution. Now, this is something that there was a lot of back and forth among the First Nations, whether or not we want to even discuss the Constitution. The Constitution didn't grant any specific Indigenous rights. It just recognized inherent rights. So our rights don't come from the Constitution. They just recognize that we do have these rights. So there was a big debate whether we should even discuss amending the Constitution, and if we were, what we were going to do. But one of the idea of human rights being added into these discussions, it's big because human rights are everybody's rights. So I was okay with including the language human rights, but I think that was still open for more discussion. And I don't think we really came to 100% agreement on how to move forward with that.
With the agenda and the speed of the federal government is trying to implement these major projects, how would you rate it in terms of how concerned you are going forward?
Well, I think it, once again, it depends on the project. Some are more to us. We understand why they're major project affiliated. Something like Darlington, we know that we are going to increase our power needs by double by the year 2050. Then you have a project like Aalto, where we still haven't been told why we need a high-speed rail from Toronto to Montreal. There really hasn't been a big push to explain to us why this is so important. You don't hear people saying we need more high-speed rail between Toronto and Montreal. So we haven't heard much about that. And so this is something why we'd be a bit more hesitant to support a project like that. So I think when we look at these other ones, and over the Arctic radar, we know that we need to have that national defense. This is a project that they're thinking of putting in. So we understand that. We just want to ensure that we know some of the sites are heavily archaeologically significant. So we're in there right now, and we just want to be able to have the time to be able to extract anything that we don't want destroyed.
I'm glad you mentioned Darlington, because Alderville is engaged in two potential major projects. The first being, of course, as you mentioned, the Darlington nuclear plant, which we spoke about recently between the Williams Treaty and the Ontario Power Generation and the Ontario government. The other potential project is Wesleyville. Now, after being at the assembly and hearing the debates, has it changed your attitude or your approach to these projects involving Alderville?
I think it helped bring that national perspective to these projects. So far, we've been inordinately involved in these major projects because two of them are running right through our territory, whereas a lot of the other First Nations, they have different concerns when you look at, say, the Ring of Fire or a big transnational pipeline, all these other things that that affect different First Nations. So I think it put that national perspective more upfront and showed that we do need a process that can meet the needs of all these different projects, no matter what they are. So I think it's good to be able to see each one independently, but it's also good to know what is the process that the federal government is trying to implement here, because First Nations are affected on all of them.
Was there any pushback at the assembly from other First Nations to the Darlington deal?
Well, we were expecting a little bit of pushback, but by and large, the speakers commended the project for happening. We were all the Williams Treaty First Nations chiefs, as far as I could see, were being approached by people that were congratulating the Williams Treaty First Nations for entering into that economic partnership. So generally, we were quite pleased to be seeing that positively received by the assembly. So we were a little bit concerned that you know, there might be some people that weren't too happy with it, but by and large, I only heard positive feedback.
I'd like to now talk about some discussions around clean water. The federal government's new proposed clean water legislation became a hot topic at the assembly. There are 40 long-term drinking water advisories affecting 37 communities currently. What happened that caused such an uproar?
Well, clean water has been one of the most emotionally charged topics that we've discussed at the AFN assembly for the past several years. Some First Nations have been struggling to get any semblance of clean water. they tell you stories of how they turn the taps on and the water is like yellow and cloudy and milky, and there's no way you would ever even think about consuming that water or cooking with that water. So this is something that the government hasn't lived up to the responsibility of providing clean water for First Nations people. It seems like for the rest of Canada, it's quite easy to get clean water to the communities, to the cities. But as soon as you're talking about First Nations, all of a sudden, you know, the government's not quite as interested in ensuring everyone's got clean drinking water. So it's one of those things that you don't really look at it that way. And we need to ensure that these necessary steps are taken to implement the changes that are needed right now. And it's not always about money. It's about how these systems are developed, these water treatment systems are developed.
There's quite the history to this legislation, especially the fact that it failed to pass by the previous government because an election was called. Why do you think the demand that the right to clean water was dropped in this latest version?
Well, I think so when you look back to see what was in Bill C-61, this is a bill that we as First Nations worked hard with the federal government to draft. We are almost 100% agreed that this was a great bill. We had worked years on consultation for it. So what we put in there, what was in there, was something that was we were very comfortable with. And then when they introduced Bill C-37, they decided that they weren't going to explicitly say that clean drinking water is a human right. This is something that we were very disappointed in, because it means that they don't necessarily see it as the real goal to get clean drinking water to First Nations. It also had this limited jurisdiction, and we know that this is not something that's acceptable to us, because we need to be in charge of our water if we're going to, you know, take on the authority and liability for that clean water in our communities.
Is this a budget issue for the federal government, as the Liberals are focused on economic and trade issues at the moment?
I think it is. I think it's more than just the cost for to achieve clean drinking water in the First Nations. I believe that there's a lot of other adjacent issues, such as the upstream clean water. So Bill C-61 took into consideration the water coming into the communities from other sources. And so we might be downstream from, say, a factory or a facility, some type of industry that is polluting that water. So this is now left out of the current Bill C-37. So there's no, if one of the First Nations is being polluted upstream by a factory, this bill doesn't speak to it whatsoever. So that is that economic issue. So they're more worried about that profit coming from that facility than they are from First Nations having clean water to drink.
There were some members of the assembly calling the changes racist and discriminatory. How do you see it?
I believe there's a lot of the paternalistic language in the new legislation. So it doesn't quite hit the mark in terms of respecting our ability and authority over our water. It says basically the federal government knows what's best for us and how they're going to deliver clean water services. So they haven't been able to get it right yet. You have First Nations that have been under boiled water advisory for over a decade, and they're saying, trust us, we're going to do it right this time. So we can't trust them, because they promised clean drinking water in the First Nations communities 10 years ago, and nothing has changed for several of the worst communities. So we really believe that it's time for the federal government to step back and engage with First Nations on how best to bring these changes.
It was reported that Liberal MP and Parliamentary Secretary for Indigenous Services, Jeanette Levac, along with some other government representatives, did not publicly respond to delegates' questions on this topic. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. I remember when she was speaking, again, these bureaucrats and politicians, they always say something well. But then after the water plenary, a number of chiefs came up and directly asked these presenters questions. and none of those questions were answered. So after the Chiefs asked their questions, that was pretty much it. There was no effort for the presenters to actually respond to any of these questions. Then they just sat there with blank looks on their faces. Sorry if that insults anybody that was there and is listening to this. But no, none of these questions were answered.
As she was leaving, she spoke to the news media. She said, and I'm quoting here, "It means we're going to continue to make concerted efforts in order to help realize that right, and that we are putting ourselves forward and saying we are committed to this." How do you respond to her comments to the media?
Well, this has been the new change in language that the federal government's been using. They're saying best efforts. Instead of saying we are going to do this, they're saying we're going to do our best to try to do this. So anytime you give that out that they're able to take, they will take that out. So they know that it's not a priority. It hasn't been said that we have to get clean water. It's just saying they're going to try to get us clean water. So these are the slight changes that from the bills that we really can't support. So because of these changes, the First Nations decided that this is not a clean drinking water bill that that we can support.
How do you think this is going to get resolved?
Well, hopefully they listen to what we've been saying and they add this stronger language that they took out, the language that was already developed. I hope that they put them back in, because you can't have a First Nations Clean Drinking Water Act that we don't agree with, that we disagree with. It's for us. We need to be able to have a say in what's in that legislation.
You and I don't often talk about young people, but there were two resolutions at the assembly that focused on youth. The first was in support of youth getting access to digital and culturally grounded education in remote communities. And the second was a post-secondary initiative to train young people, giving them skills training. What happened with those?
Well, those were by and large supported. I think that these are good initiatives that we need to be pushing. I know that even in our community that's not very remote, we have issues with culturally appropriate education in terms of learning the culture and the language. So I can imagine that these issues would be magnified in First Nations community, especially if you're bringing in teachers from far outside the community, which they often do. They bring in lots of different employees for these remote First Nations for whatever reason, skills, education, but oftentimes there's no specific onus on the culture, or they even if they want to teach the language and culture, they just don't have that information. And in terms of skills and trade, this is something that we have been working on here in Alderville ourselves, but it's we really need to ensure that our youth are properly trained and educated for all the different jobs that are out there now. In the past, First Nations were given very specific education sets, and these were basic, not lower level, but they'd be like in farming. They were just not really what we wanted to be doing. It's what the government wanted us to be doing. So now we want to be fully engaged in the current 21st century economy, and we want to ensure our youth are properly trained and have access to all those opportunities.
I know that when we were talking about the Darlington project recently, you were talking about the importance of skilled trades in the community on the opportunity for jobs in that particular project. Can you put together what you've just told us about these initiatives at the federal level and the ability for you to be able to train young people locally to take on jobs at an important project like this?
Yes. So I think, in the early stages of it, we would be looking at those construction level positions. We would love to get our youth working on the building and development of the facilities. But in the long run, we would love to see a commitment by the federal government and the universities to ensure that First Nations have that opportunity to engage in the education required for the nuclear sector. And this is what I'm thinking. We need all sorts of skills and talents to be able to run these nuclear facilities. So we are economic 20% ownership partners. We would love to be able to have our our youth trained to be able to fully participate in that. Now I know you can't, you know, tell someone that you got to take science, you got to become a nuclear scientist. But if a youth really wants to do that, they should have every opportunity. I know that we are very supportive of our students. We just had our student awards yesterday, and it was just incredible to see how successful some of our youth are at what they're doing abroad in school. So we have the talent. We just want to ensure that we have those partnerships in place with the various economic and education facilities to make that work, and be that skilled trades or higher education. We want to make sure that they have every opportunity available to them.
First Nations are invited to participate in the October First Ministers Conference. This is the first time in 20 years First Nations will be participating as full partners at the table rather than attending side meetings. Who's going on behalf of First Nations, and what do First Nations want to see on the agenda?
That is still being determined. The different regions of Canada will be putting forth their own representatives. So the Ontario region would have a certain number of chiefs that they can send. And this is what we are still figuring out. I'm on the committee that's deciding what topics we want to discuss. And of course, we have to work in unison with the other First Nations. We want to make sure we're speaking with one voice, that the issues we're going to be discussing are going to be the issues that everyone wants to discuss. So it's there's kind of two lines of thinking. Is this going to be those constitutional level talks that we had in the 80s and the 90s with Lake Charlottetown and Meech Lake and Section 35 of the Constitution? Or is this going to be more like the Kelowna Accord level discussions, where it's about policies and programming and, say, funding for specific things? We feel it should be more in the bigger issues and not just the on the ground issues that we are already discussing across the board. So we feel this is a once in a generation opportunity, and we don't want to squander that, because I remember the last time we were dealing with this on that big level, I was just a small kid, and I don't want to, you know, not take advantage of this and then have our kids and our grandkids have to come back to the table in 40 years and pick up where we left off. So I want to ensure that we've done as much as possible to meet the needs historically and for the future.
Did anyone at the assembly speak against being involved in this meeting, or was it unanimous that representatives be sent?
No, it was definitely unanimous. This is an opportunity that everyone realized is important. If there was any discussion, it's about what should be discussed. Like, are we going to ask to open up the Constitution? Are we not going to? What are the big issues we're going to discuss? I put forward some issues when I addressed the assembly. So this is something that, you know, there's vast support for. And it's probably because of the major projects. We know the federal government wants to get these major projects through, and we know that they have to go through us to get them through. So we feel that this is probably why they're having a First Minister's meeting. So we can talk about these major projects, but if we're in the door, we're going to be talking about all of the major issues.
What were the items you suggested?
Well, the main one is the elephant in the room that I call it. It's the Indian Act. The Indian Act is now 150 years old. It legislates that First Nations are wards of the state. So as long as we're talking about treaties, inherent rights, Section 35 rights, international law, as long as we're legislated wards of the state, we're not going to get anywhere. The Indian Act needs to be replaced with an act respecting the rights, the treaty rights and inherent rights of First Nations. So this is basically going to redraw the map on how First Nations are involved in Canada on an everyday basis. So I think no one's in disagreement that the Indian Act has to go eventually. So this would be a great time to finally get those discussions going.
With everything the federal government is facing in terms of international trade, tariffs, diversifying the economy, potential separatism referendums, and all these things that are on their plate, do you think there is an appetite to delve into the Indian Act and to start those kinds of discussions at this time?
I think there has to be, because it's a way that the companies that want these major projects done can get those guarantees that the federal government hasn't been able to give them yet. I believe that we need to finally set the table in a way that we're all on the same page as a nation, and that a company is not going to get the rug pulled out from under because the federal government didn't do their due diligence on a specific project. So the First Nations were unanimous that we do not support Alberta independence and separation from the nation. So like, there's a lot of ways that we can work together. So I think that we can support these bigger national issues. It's just that we need to work on what's in our own backyard, but we can also, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. So we're able to discuss all the different issues.
So you see the Indian Act being tied into all of this at the same level?
I do. I really do.
Let's talk about the powwow. How do you think it went?
Oh my goodness. That's the first day of the powwow. Just, it blew me away on how many people were there in terms of guests, attendance, and dancers from all over. I don't remember seeing so many dancers in all of the different categories that we saw there. Just the number of jingle dress dancers was amazing. We had great vendors, great food. And it was just, there's no rain. It wasn't too hot. So it really was a perfect day. And then day two on Sunday was more of the same. There wasn't as many people there, but in a lot of ways that kind of made it more, it was a bit easier because after that first long day, I was a little tired. So the second day was just a little bit easier, but it was just as thoroughly enjoyable.
Any idea of how many people attended?
No, not yet. I don't think we've crunched the numbers. We probably have people that were clocked in through the door, but you always have the people that have set up the night before. You have all the vendors that were there. So, I mean, we could probably put the drone video up and then count to see. But then a lot of people only come for an hour or two and then they move on. So in terms of actual number of people that came in through both days, I'm not sure if we'll ever get that number. It's almost more of just a feeling, but I'd love to be able to count that if we could.
What was the biggest difference between last year and this year?
Well, I think the biggest difference probably would have been weather-wise. It was just too hot last year, and then it rained, big rainstorm on the second day. So I think that probably kept a bunch of people away, the heat. This year, I think people looked at the forecast. They saw that it was going to be sunny and not too hot. So people was like, okay, this weekend we're going to the powwow. So I believe the weather was the biggest difference, but also the organization. Our powwow committee really did a great job of having everything organized. It was running a very tight operation across the board. And that work that you put in up front really showed in how the powwow was organized and how it took place.
The regalia that some of the dancers were wearing was absolutely spectacular.
Yes, so this is directly aligned with the rejuvenation of the culture in our community and in all the other communities around that come and participate. In Alderville, we have regalia making for our members. So this is something that goes on all year. If you want to say undertake a specific line of dance, then you have a specific regalia set that you would need to make. So every dance has its own regalia. So you would choose your dance, you would choose the regalia, and then over the course of the year, you would attend the regalia making workshops and put together your regalia and hopefully have it in time for powwow. But no one ever does. Everyone's about 80% done like 2 weeks before the powwow, and everyone just gets it done right at the last minute. And the people are like, I was staying up last night to get this regalia done. So it's incredible that everyone does that. And then the regalia is really of a high quality. So as some people get older, they will pass it on to their children, and then their children will wear it. And then they'll make maybe a new set. So you have all this regalia being made. they get the youth into it. And a lot of the older people now were the youth who were originally into it 32 years ago, I believe, was the first powwow in Alderville. So these traditions are now being taught down. And people really want to make sure that their kids and their grandkids are involved. It's something that that once the children get involved, they attend these regalia workshops. They might not make the regalia, but their parents who already have their regalia will maybe make the set for their child or grandchildren or children. So it's really symbolic of the rejuvenation of the culture, not just in Alderville, but in all the First Nations.
I noticed that there was a lot of youth participation, especially really young children.
Well, the powwow is such a major event in Alderville. In the past, there was the regatta that was our big event, but now, without a doubt, the powwow is, it's something that we're excited about. We always talk about, and I think we get the kids excited about it too. And so I think just because of that, they're excited to be there. Maybe if it's their first time, they don't know what it is, but then when they get there, they love it. They love seeing all their friends. Seeing their aunties and their grandparents, going around to the different stores to see all the different vendors. You'll have your beautiful beadwork and your necklaces. You'll have a lot of the ribbon shirts and ribbon skirts. So it really gets them excited and says that, you know, what they've been working on and thinking about is real. And it's something that you can look forward to every single year. So I think each year the young kids get a bit more excited. So by the time they're around like 7 or 8 and they've been to a few powwows, it's just it's something that they've really latched onto, and it's become like a big part of their cultural life.
What was your impression of the drummers?
Well, we usually have 4 or 5 drum groups, and then they will alternate for different dances. So the MC will announce which drum group is going, and then they'll be ready to go, and then they'll have practiced all their songs. So you have these drum groups that maybe every 5th song they'll do one, or they'll do 2 or 3 in a row, and then another drum group will do 2 or 3 in a row. And they're just so amazing this year. We had Smoke Trail Singer dance drummers from Alderville, and a lot of the other local drum groups were there. So it's really good that we had them. And we had one award-winning drum group that was with us all weekend, and we were really honored to have them. But all the drum groups sounded so incredible. I was just proud of all of them. It's great to see them, and the drumming and the singing was top notch.
Volunteers are a critical part of the powwow.
Yes. So we, starting maybe a couple months before the powwow, we have our powwow committee that has started, and all the staff are welcome to come to it. And we have so many jobs that need to be happening, like in terms of being at the gate or at the parking or running the shuttle, making sure that the grounds are clean, changing the garbage. So we have like a small army of, I don't want to quite say volunteers, because they are staff that that are, you know, are gave up their weekends to come work for us. So it's not every staff member that comes out, but the ones that choose to come, it's just so incredible. My my daughter was working the powwow for the first time this year, and she had a great time. So she was working both the parking and the front gate. So this was something that, you know, we really need these people. Like if it wasn't for the staff and staff volunteering their time, we wouldn't be able to run the powwow. So we're just so thankful for our staff that came out and gave up their weekend to bring such an incredible event to the community.
When does the planning for next year begin?
Well, I think right away, because we have like the post powwow meeting where we have like what went right, what went wrong, what can we do better. So right away, like the planning for next year's powwow has already started, and it starts with that meeting. And then there won't be as much, you won't have like the regular weekly powwow meeting, but you will have meetings about like, what are we going to do? How are we going to improve the powwow grounds for next year? So we'll come up with a plan if there's something that we need to do better, or say perhaps build more structures. Then we would plan that now so that for the spring construction period, we'd be able to get everything done for next time. But anyone who comes to our powwow annually will notice how the grounds have improved every single year. They're expanding, they're getting better. And this is something that's an ongoing thing. So really the powwow it's an ongoing project that really never stops.
Chief Simpson, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.